morning, everyone. Welcome back to day two here in Portland. Not as sunny as it was yesterday. Hope you all had a good night last night. I'm going to kick off the morning with a presentation on the state of the ecosystem report from Dr. Joe Caracappa and the review from the SSC from Dr. Connor McManus. So I will turn it over to you, Dr. Caracappa.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good morning, everybody. So I'm Joe Caracappa. This is probably my third year presenting the State of the Ecosystem for the New England Council. So I'm the lead editor, but this is a center product that has maybe 60 different contributors from within NOAA and academic partners, and a lot of contributions from the industry and the public this year. So happy to be here. So for those not familiar with the State of the Ecosystem process, it originated out of the Integrated Ecosystem Assessment Framework, whereby we evaluate management objectives, we find indicators that are used to assess them, we qualify the risk relating to those management objectives, and then we present and iterate. So this is, I think, the eighth year that we've been doing this cycle. And so it's an iterative product, and we're working on trying to integrate it into more specific management processes, either through risk policies or the risk assessments on both Mid-Atlantic and New England regions. So thinking about the scale of what we're talking about in the State of the Ecosystem, based on its name, it's at the ecosystem scale. So generally, we're not looking at individual stocks, and we're not looking at specific areas. We're looking at the whole system and trying to identify patterns and processes that dictate across that whole scale. We do have similar information on a stock-specific level that's produced in the ecosystem and socioeconomic profile work at the Science Center, and that is something more targeted that we're thinking of trying to expand in the coming years. So the report is structured into four main sections. The first is a high-level summary. The second is where we evaluate specific management objectives, and we try to ask, what is an indicator saying? How does it relate to the objective? And why do we think that it's doing what it's doing? And then the third section is evaluating risks to specific management objectives. And then the last section is a last year highlights current observations, where we try to synthesize the previous year and identify some of the major events that happened and how they might relate to fisheries. So Dr. McManus is going to talk about this in a little bit, but we do track the requests that the council and SSEs make for both New England and the Mid-Atlantic, and we that should have been in the summary, the briefing materials, but we provide a memo where we evaluate what we were able to do, what we weren't able to do, and how the SSEs and us prioritized some of that work. So we've been trying to kind of improve that process over the last few years. You'll see a lot of kind of repeated structure in the figures throughout the presentation. When we talk about spatial scales, for New England specifically, we do break things between the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank based on this map here on the left. And when we talk about trends in time series, we show a positive trends, increasing trends in orange, and decreasing trends in purple. And if the last 10 years has a different trend than the main trend, we have a second line there in the last 10 years showing that short-term recent trend. Okay, so at a high level, this is our report card for the Georges Bank ecosystem based on our six different management objectives. With regards to all of these, we will be going through them in more detail with some of the data to support it. But in general, when we look at seafood production, we're looking at total and council-managed landings, as well as recreational landings. So those have all been declining over the long term, and we're currently sitting below the long-term average. The second objective is commercial profits, where we look at both revenue and a profit index of council-managed species. We don't have a long-term trend in Georgia's Bank, but we're currently below the long-term average. With regards to recreational opportunities, we're looking at both recreational effort and the diversity of the recreational fleet and the catch. With regards to effort, we're not seeing a trend, but we're below average. And the diversity metrics have mixed trends, so we don't have a clear signal on whether we're going, you know, some are positive, some are negative. Recently, we made a change to our assessment of stability, where we look at ecosystem and fishery stability. And now we evaluate that based on whether we're seeing the system change from an historical baseline, whether there's a change in the adaptive capacity of either the fishery or the ecosystem, and then whether we have any measures of volatility, whether increasing or decreasing volatility. So in the case for both the fishery and the ecosystem, we're both seeing signs of instability. And then with regards to social and cultural objectives, we're looking at the community dependence on environmentally sensitive species, as well as some community level risk factors relating to the actual population in that community. And so we do see some increase in the dependence on environmentally and climate-dependent sensitive species, but the actual risk factors kind of vary by community. And then the last objective is our protective species. So we're looking at coastwide bycatch rates and whether we're meeting metrics for those and the actual population numbers of those species. So with regards to bycatch, we have some mixed trends, but we're meeting our objectives. And with regards to our populations, we have mixed trends, and we're currently below the target for North Atlantic right whale, but gray seals have been increasing. So the Gulf of Maine is very similar for all of these, except for the seafood production and commercial profits. The main difference here is with regards to revenue, we've been seeing an increase in total revenue from the Gulf of Maine ecosystem, but a decrease in the managed revenue. So that differs from Georgia's Bank. But the rest of the objectives are the same for both regions because they're region-wide. So I'll go into these more specifically, but just to frame it, we look at four different main risk factors with regards to management. We look at the risk to managing spatially, so how quotas are allocated, how you manage discard rates and fishing targets depend on species distributions, and we've been seeing shifts in species distributions over the whole ecosystem, and so we talk about some of the risks related to that. We look at seasonal management risks. These are specifically things relating to spawning closures or seasonal openings and closures and have to do with assumptions on the timing of species life cycle events. The third is risk to setting catch limits. And so this has to do with assumptions regarding the productivity of a stock and how it changes over time and how we set quotas and rebuilding plans based on those information. And then the last has to do with marine development. In the current conditions, most of that is relating to offshore wind development. And so we talk about how the fact that we have actual projects in the water now and what some of the potential impacts of that can be. So new this year are our operational ocean forecasts using the MOM-6 model at NOAA. So this is something that we're trying to advertise as a potential tool to use for addressing different management questions. So we have two main products from that we highlight in the State of the Ecosystem report. The first is a one-year forecast where we can estimate whether for the figure on the left is bottom temperature, and we're predicting whether we're likely to be cooler, warmer, or near average seasonally. And so when we look at this, we can, instead of using something like the historical average as the reference point, one could look at stock-specific reference points of concern and get forecasted output from this. And so we're working on ways to further make this more applicable for stock-specific questions. On the right are our decadal forecasts. So these are maybe less precise than the annual forecasts, but they give us a longer-term outlook at what the ecosystem level conditions look like. And so when the model was run in retrospective forecast mode, where you're trying to re-predict things that have already happened, it does fairly well. And it also was able to predict the dramatic cooling that we experienced in the ecosystem over the last couple of years. That model is showing a return to kind of average conditions, but not necessarily as warm as they were in the past decade over the next 10 years. And so we're also exploring opportunities to kind of use that longer term outlook to help aid different management decisions on a strategic level. All right, and lastly, for the high-level summary, we have our ecosystem highlights. So we solicited a lot of feedback from the industry and the public, as well as other academic partners, and basically anyone that had experience on the water in the last year, and tried to synthesize different reports that we got and coalesce them into somewhat of a narrative for the past year. I'll show a little more about this later, but for the most part, a lot of the observations we received this year had to do with the cool conditions that we saw. And so we relate that to some of the shifts in oceanography and the Gulf Stream position, allowing more cold water to come into the system. And then a lot of the species-specific observations related to the seasonal and spatial timing of different stocks and where people on the water were seeing fish differently than they expected or had in previous years. And then we also highlight some of the recent offshore wind development and where that's occurring. So as of last year, the State of the Ecosystem team was able to address a few of the long lists of requests that we've been tracking. Those are summarized in that memo attached to the report. But for the most part, a lot of it had to do with integrating kind of preliminary data sets more formally into the report and working on some of the structure and narrative behind ecosystem stability and some of the more administrative tasks relating to evaluating trends in different ways, especially the short-term trends. And then here is a list of the high priority tasks that remain in progress. And so some, but not all, these are, you know, being worked on in different capacity. So this subset is kind of what we're working towards, but not necessarily for the following year's report. Okay, so that's the high level. We'll get into some of the weeds on the specific management objectives here. So when we look at seafood production, we're looking at landings. We're looking at total landings for a region, as well as those managed by the council. And so we see a decrease in landings across all three of those categories. And the drivers of these, there's a lot of potential drivers, but some of them have to do with ecosystem and stock level production. Some of them have to do with market conditions and environmental change. And we're working on ways to better tease out, like, what's the predominant driver for specific regions and specific stocks. But when we look at the kind of the catch portfolio for New England, we see that they are kind of at a moderately dominant level. They're moderately dependent on species that are sensitive to environmental change, specifically warming. And so when you have environmental variability, that does pose an increased risk of not having kind of predictable outputs or being able to maintain a certain level of seafood production. When we look at recreational harvest, we see long-term declines in recreational landings and a recent decline in recreational shark landings. So the drivers of these are a little different with regards to sharks. Most of that is due to the closure of the Mako fishery. The total recreational harvest decline is most likely a shift in the fishing behavior of recreational anglers. We're trying to get better data on whether that's because they're not fishing for subsistence anymore or they're increasing the rate of catch and release, because what we are looking at here is recreational landings, not catch. So if it's not landed, then it doesn't get recorded here. So when we have declines across the board, the first question is this due to kind of stock status or the particular management required to rebuild particular stocks? So if we look across all the New England managed stocks, we have a lot of them with no FMSY reference point, and so we can't evaluate whether overfishing is occurring for those. But when we look at the biomass reference point, we do have a lot of them in a depleted status and are requiring rebuilding. So across the entire stock portfolio for the Mid-Atlantic managed species, you do have a lot of species that are not able to be fished more because of their current status. So that is one of the main contributors, we think, to the overall decline in production for the region. When we look at the actual resource availability on an ecosystem level, we're looking at the biomass from the Federal Trawl Survey, and we see that we have long-term increases in large species groupings. So planktivores, piscivores, benthivores are all different broad categories of fish, not necessarily just the ones that are being managed. And so we do see increases over time in a lot of those stocks, suggesting that it's not a fact of the ecosystem becoming less productive. It's just a decline in productivity of the managed species. And so that's a bit of a distinction that we're trying to make clearer this year. And so whether that means there's other opportunities for other species that we're not currently looking at in the managed portfolio, that's a work that needs to be continued. So summarizing here, for seafood production, we're seeing declines in managed stocks, but not in the ecosystem as a whole. And so we need to continue to evaluate whether this is related solely to shifting distributions, historical impacts on fish stocks, and how the overall system productivity interacts with the managed species, and evaluate kind of how the stability of the system's changed over time and whether we're seeing substantial changes in fishing behavior and engagement across the sectors. So next, we look at commercial profits. And the first indicator for that is just the overall revenue for the total revenue from the region and the revenue generated by council-managed species. So this is place-based, so where the catch was occurring. So for the catch in Georges Bank, we see no long-term trend in this oscillating pattern with peaks and troughs, mostly due to the scallop rotational management. So we see the revenue not really trending, but we're currently below average. In the Gulf of Maine, we see a much different story with the rise in total revenue over time for all species, but a decline in the council-managed species. So the difference here is predominantly lobster, although that total management total revenue has been declining over the last 10 years. When we look at the catch portfolio in regards to revenue, kind of weighted by revenue instead of landings, we see a similar story where we're at a we're moderately dependent on these species that are sensitive to climate and environmental variability. And so that does pose a risk of being able to maintain the current levels of revenue if there's some sort of event that negatively impacts those species. But then we could further kind of break down the revenue stream into its components, whether it's driven by the landings on their own or changes in prices. And so that's what the figure on the right is showing. So in Georgia's Bank, we currently have low volume of landings, particularly in the shellfish, which are driving that decreased revenue for the last year. And that's different than in the Gulf of Maine, where we're seeing the increase in revenue mostly driven by higher prices in the last year. We have a new indicator of profitability that looks at the costs available for federal trips only. And so this is kind of looking at the interplay between revenue costs and what the profitability index would be. So it's not necessarily like the absolute profit, but it's an index of profitability. In Georgia's Bank, we kind of have these contrasting periods where costs rise or fall, and that kind of drives the overall profitability. Costs are in that red line there, and the profit index is in the green. And so we're currently in a period of low profitability, but the costs related to federal trips have come significantly down, which has kind of offset the declines in revenue. In the Gulf of Maine, we have a very different pattern where the costs are really proportional to the revenue for the most part, and so the costs are constant, so the revenue is the dictator of the profitability index here. And so we're currently sitting around the long-term average for that. So next we look at recreational opportunities. So this is a plot of recreational effort. And so despite us coming down pretty harshly after a peak in 2010, it has stabilized over the last 10 years, and we're not seeing any long-term or short-term trends relating to effort. And so based on this, the total number of rec opportunities over the last decade has been relatively constant. But when we look at rec catch and fleet diversity, so catch diversity is the diversity of the species caught, and the fleet diversity is the type of rec trip being done over time. We don't see a big change in the effort diversity after a decline into the 1990s, but the diversity of catch has been increasing, suggesting that rec anglers are catching a wider range of species in New England, but that there hasn't been a substantial change in what means that they're participating in the fishery. So next we look at social and cultural objectives. So this is a new indicator on the left. This is commercial port activity. So this is a combination of dealer data, landings, and permit data. And so we look at those on the port level and try to see how the total activity of that port is changing over time. So in New England, we have New Bedford as being the dominant port in terms of activity. It has been lower in the last in the current year than at the start of the time series, but we don't have enough years to have like a statistical analysis of the trend. But you can see that the relative order of the ranking of the ports in terms of port activity is fairly consistent over time, but the amount of activity in some of the smaller ports has been increasing over the last 10 years. And so we're trying to evaluate this further and kind of understand what's driving individual port changes over time. In particular for New Bedford, when we look at census indicators on different community level risk factors, we see that it does sit in that medium high to high range for those census-based vulnerability factors. And so that leads to some concerns about how changes in that port activity over time might relate to the actual population of the residents of that community. And on the right there, we have a figure of the recreational communities in terms of their engagement in the fishery, and then on the y-axis relative to their population size. And so this hasn't been updated since last year, and we're working on trying to integrate a similar style port activity index, but from a recreational lens for these. When we look at the region as a whole for New England, we can kind of look at what the proportion of communities that are more or less dependent on these environmentally sensitive species. And we see a pretty big shift in the kind of the average ranking. And so we're seeing a lot more communities over the last 20 years shift towards that more high to very high dependence on these species, and some of the moderately dependent communities become less predominant. So those communities, you know, you could think about them shifting from a moderate to a high dependence on environmentally sensitive species. So when we look at protected species, we have two main species that we evaluate the bycatch rates for. The first is harbor porpoise. And so we're currently sitting at a low bycatch rate, significantly below the projected biological removal. And when we look at gray seals, they've been increasing in bycatch, mostly thought to be due to the increase in the actual population, increasing their interaction with the fishery. And currently, because of some of the uncertainty regarding the anthropogenic impacts, they're currently also meeting their management objectives despite still increasing in their bycatch rates. When we look at North Atlantic right whale, the total population size has come down since a peak in 2010, but they've currently been relatively stable over the last few years, but they're still at a point where their mortality is higher than their recovery rate. And so the protection of the right whale population is still considered to be very important. And then we look at the calf abundance for right whales. So they did bounce back from nearly zero calves in 2018. But there is some variability in the time series. And so despite us not seeing a long-term trend, we're still kind of monitoring this year to year. And we also report on Atlantic salmon based on the return rates from hatchery-reared individuals, and those have been declining kind of substantially over the last, the entire duration of the time series. And so Atlantic salmon still remain a concern due to that declining return rate. Okay. And so lastly, we try to synthesize this in a new framework for fishery stability. Again, we're looking at volatility of indices, the adaptive capacity of the system, how well can it respond to change, and then shifts from a baseline. So does the current conditions look like past conditions, or are we expecting them to look different? And so there's a little bit of guidance that we provide in the report about what we're actually saying about stability. Stable systems doesn't necessarily mean that everything is great and we don't have to worry about changes in the system. It just means we're not seeing any changes. And being not stable does mean that we're seeing large-scale changes in the system and that these may be altering kind of the structure and function of that system. So when we look at fishery stability in New England, we're seeing a decline in the number of fleets. We're seeing from the crew survey an aging crew with changes in the perceptions relating to their satisfaction with fishing. We're seeing the size and participation of different communities changing. And we are seeing a decrease in the ability for communities to adapt to changes in the environment because of their increased dependence on species sensitive to climate and environmental changes. If we actually look at the fishery data, we are seeing changes in revenue per unit effort, diversity, So we're being more dependent on fewer species, and we have rotational management of sea scallops, which can kind of decrease the predictability of revenue. And so for these reasons, we are making the case that our fisheries are currently not stable. When we look at the ecosystem, we do separate Georges Bank and the Gulf of Maine. So in Georges Bank, we are seeing a wide-scale shift in the zooplankton communities across multiple species. And so this is not something that you would expect in kind of a system at equilibrium. You shouldn't have changes on these broad multi-species scales. And so we're seeing broad shifts in those. And then from the survey, also across large groupings of species, we're seeing long-term changes in the abundance of some but not all species, suggesting that the actual ecosystem community of fish is changing over time. In the Gulf of Maine, it's a little bit of a different story. We're seeing, if we look at the traits of fish as a whole and what type of community they have and what the characteristics of the fish community are, we've been seeing an increase in the trophic level of species in the Gulf of Maine that have a shorter length of maturity, lower fecundity, but faster growth rates. And if we look at the survey, we're starting to see, well, we have seen over time, an increase in the number of species caught in the survey, suggesting that there are more individual species present in the Gulf of Maine than there had been previously. And so this sort of large-scale change in the ecological community suggests that we're currently undergoing some significant region-wide changes. Okay. So next, we look at the risks related to management objectives. We look at seasonal, spatial, and setting catch limits or productivity. So we see across the entire shelf these wide-scale changes in species distribution, species moving towards the northeast and into deeper water. We see this not just from the trawl survey, but also from protected species and whales. And so we are concerned with, you know, spatial allocation, cross-jurisdictional management, the effectiveness of bycatch measures, and the availability of species to particular surveys. So why are the species changing their distribution? We dig into a bit of the why here. We look at the biological drivers. Are they following their food? Some species are mobile and can follow their prey. And so if we look at the forage fish distribution, we see that they're also shifting towards the northeast across the entire shelf. But this isn't true for all food, because we're seeing for macrobenthos not the same type of northeastern trend that we see in the forage fish. So depending on what the species is and what their predominant prey is, their food may or may not be moving along with that kind of global trend. And if we look at the zooplankton as another food source, we are seeing some distribution shifts in zooplankton, particularly with regards to the copepod distributions, where they're shifting more towards the northeast as well. And so depending on species preference and their mobility, this can kind of create either a magnet effect where they're moving along with their prey source, or a productivity issue if they're not able to follow their prey. There's a variety of environmental drivers that can affect species distributions. We've heard a lot about temperature. We know that it's been getting warmer over the long term, but we can also have these kind of dramatic shifts in temperature like we have the last couple of years in New England, which relate to temperature variability. And that variability interacts with species differently depending on how well they can adjust their position and where they are related to their ideal habitat. But we see that if we look at the broad oceanographic patterns as well, the Gulf Stream has actually been shifting more north over time, bringing warmer water up with it. And then we have these kind of localized effects of things like the Mid-Atlantic cold pool that some New England managed species use as spawning and winter refuge. And that has been showing very high variability over the last 10 years. We're currently in we've had a good cold pool for the last couple of years, but you can see from the time series here, the extent of that feature has been varying pretty wildly over time. And so when we're talking about spatial management, we really need to consider what species we're talking about, what its main drivers are. These are not a one-size-fit-all solution for every species, and depending on their food and their preferred habitat, you can be getting very different outlooks. So things like species distribution modeling and scenario planning can be helpful in planning for species distribution shifts and how to respond to that. And so we're going to continue to kind of monitor those changes and report any of the upcoming work that it's more related to specific species distribution shifts in some of the ecosystem and socioeconomic profile work. So next we look at seasonal management. So again, this has to do with fishing seasons, opening enclosures, and it essentially is about the assumptions around the timing of species life cycle events. So if you're expecting spawn to be a certain day of the year, but it changes because of environmental conditions or other conditions, you might be misaligning management measures with the actual life cycle of the species. And so we are really kind of short on wide-scale observations for this. This requires like a lot of frequent sampling for species across multiple years. And so right now what we're looking at are some case studies. So we're looking at yellowtail and haddock. And so based on the timing of their maturity from the surveys, we can see that they have had a shift in when spawning has occurred for those specific species, and suggesting that this is something we should explore maybe for other species as well that have very sensitive timing constraints with regards to seasonality. But as a whole, we see kind of more anecdotally large migratory shifts in the timing of migrations for different species. So for recreational tuna, we've been seeing them being caught earlier than they used to be. We see right and humpback whale spring habitat usage occurring later than it used to be. And we're trying to establish kind of these baseline timing reference points to compare to current events to try to get a better idea of where the best place to start investigating some of these timing shifts could come from. But we do know that the environment, the timing of the environmental events has been changing significantly. When we look at the duration of the seasons, we see that summer is getting longer. And so on the left here is the time between spring and fall, which is basically the length of the summer. And so we're seeing summer get expanded in time and conditions that we would associate with spring and fall getting truncated across both all of New England's habitat. And when we look at the phytoplankton and when we're getting peaks in phytoplankton blooms, we're seeing we're seeing the fall blooms get later in both Georges Bank and the Gulf of Maine, suggesting that even at the base of the food web, we're seeing shifts in when energy is entering into the system, which should have impacts of some sort, but making the connection between that and a specific stock is not something we're quite there yet with. And so for the future, we're trying to evaluate what kinds of assumptions are we making about the seasonal timing of species. Do those assumptions still hold? And what types of monitoring efforts can we develop with the resources we have now to try to understand how some of those changes are occurring? And so the last risk for management concern is relating to catch limits. And this has to do with the system's productivity as a whole. And so when we look at two different metrics, the top one is small fish per large fish. This is a proxy for kind of population scale productivity. How much new fish are you expecting to get for how many large fish you have? So it's not necessarily recruitment, but it's derived from the survey. And we see that if you stack up that estimate for all the species and look at it over time, we've been seeing a pretty sharp decline in the last 10 years. So we're currently in a low productivity period for those managed stocks, if you look across all of them. And then when you look at the recruitment estimates from the stock assessments, you also see something fairly similar where in aggregate across all the assessments, you're seeing low recruitment across many species in the last 20 or so years. And so this is a measure of the productivity of the resource and how much new production you're expecting to get out of it. And so do these assumptions of what the productivity of the stocks should be as a whole impact what we are making management decisions related to. And so we can also look at something like fish condition. So you can either view this as like the health or the weight per fish for a given length, but it also has to do with the market quality of a specific fish, how fat it is relative to its size. And we see pretty dramatic shifts by species. This is kind of one of those squint plots. You just kind of look at the colors. And so yellow is high condition relative to that species, and blue is low. And so prior to the early 2000s, we were predominantly in a high fish condition period, and then we entered a low period. And since around 2010 or so, we're kind of back in this high period, but not for all the species. And if you follow them across, the species that were high before aren't necessarily the ones that are high now. And so trying to evaluate what's driving the kind of the fatness or the condition of different species is ongoing work. And there's some work that's just being published now that we'll try to report on next year, making some of the stronger connections across stocks. But the point being is that the productivity of a species can change over time. And so what is driving that? There's a few things. The biological drivers mostly relate to the quality of their food source. And so we can look at the abundance and quality of forage fish to try to see whether there's been any changes over time. We do see some changes in abundance of forage fish, but that is not always the case when you look at the benthic food sources. And so we've been seeing a decline in the abundance of macrobenthos. So depending on what the food source for the species is, that can impact what the kind of productivity potential is at that time. And these things can also change between different seasons because things move and grow at different rates. And we can also look at other lower trophic level processes, like is just the energy input into the system, is that changing? So luckily, we don't see any changes in primary production over time, like the total energy input into the system. So we're kind of working with a fixed baseline with regards to that. But if you look at the zooplankton, we are seeing changes in zooplankton production in Georges Bank and the Gulf of Maine, depending on which type of zooplankton you're looking at. And so since you can have these shifts, that this can be a particularly strong driver for certain fish, especially those that rely heavily on zooplankton. We can also look at the traits of the fish that we are catching. And so if you look at the survey-based indicators for the traits of those fish with regards to things like growth and trophic level, and we're seeing in the Gulf of Maine especially an increase in growth rates and an increase in trophic level. And so that relates to a different kind of ecological balance within the region on what's the composition of the species at a given time, and what the characteristics of those are can change how the system as a whole produces biomass for stocks. And then we can also look at the habitat. This is a way of looking at like the temperature profile for a given year and how it relates to a species preference. In general, we've been getting kind of warmer. We're seeing warm intolerant species have less available habitat because the warm water's coming in and they have less space that actually meets their preferences. With the exception of the last couple of years where you had a really wide, expansive cold water pulse come through the region. And so this, for those species, might be preferential, but in a place like the Mid-Atlantic where you might have cold intolerant species, that could be potentially harmful. So it does depend on what species you're talking about and where you are. And then lastly, you look at these kind of large-scale oceanographic drivers. And so are you getting hypoxic events because water coming in has a different characteristic than we've had before? So we saw some hypoxia in previous years, especially in the Mid-Atlantic, that might have been a concern for some fish. And we've also had kind of low acidification events, which are below the tolerance level for sea scallops. We didn't see that last year, which is good, but it does pose the question of if you have variability in the oceanographic conditions, natural mortality is something that comes into play with stock productivity, and so you want to be able to have an idea of if you're having any changes, long-term changes in factors that impact mortality. And then we can also look at kind of larval survival. So if the fish larvae don't make it back to their spawning habitat, then they don't get recruited into the fishery. And so we've been developing a new indicator looking at ocean currents and how much of the water is being invected off the shelf, basically away from the habitat that the juveniles are occupying. And so for some species, overall, we're seeing changes in those broad oceanographic conditions depending on the season and the depth. And so we're working on ways to kind of map that to specific species to try to identify for those cases where you're getting increased amounts of water getting evicted off the shelf. And so overall, this is a lot because it depends a lot on species and region and what the main concern is. But the point is that the productivity of a stock is not a constant and that it can change depending on its environment and the biological conditions. And so being able to understand how those processes interact with the productivity of the stock and then for the productivity of the region's portfolio of stocks is something that needs to be looked into with a lot more observations and analysis that we don't have time to get into today. So looking forward to conversations on that. And the last piece for risks has to do with offshore wind development. Before this year, it was mostly hypothetical, but now we have projects in the water, and so we've kind of reshaped the analysis to talk about what's actually impacting the active projects, distinguishing those from places that have permits. And so we currently have six active projects, and those are marked on the map here in white and yellow. They're fairly small, which is why they're hard to see, but they're mostly clustered in southern New England. But there's 32 projects that have not begun construction, and this is a very fast-moving world. So this is as of January of this year. I'm sure it's already changed. With regards to the revenue associated with those project areas, we look at the revenue that had been generated in those areas by species, the largest of which is sea scallops because they have the highest price per pound. But overall, if you look at the revenue representative respect of the total revenue for that stock, they are fairly low. They're less than 1% of the total revenue for the fishery. So it depends on who you are fishing and where you're fishing. But as a whole, right now we're seeing not a large percent of the total revenue generated from the active project areas. We can look at the community level and see, based on the trips that had occurred from that port, what percent of their revenue was generated in the lease areas. So that's on the right. Because we're not reporting all of the potential lease areas and showing just the active projects, this value is fairly low, except for a few ports. So Little Compton, Rhode Island, and Westport, Mass. Have the highest, and those basically have to do with proximity to the actual active project areas right now. And so it kind of just to the point that you, despite the aggregate numbers being low, particular communities can be more harshly impacted by some of these projects. But this is not based on their current revenue, it's based on the historic revenue from that region. And so we also look at interaction for ports that land a predominantly New England managed species but are in the Mid-Atlantic region. And so that's the top left here. And so for the most part, these values are also lower because most of the active projects are not in the Mid-Atlantic. But we are showing that you know, it does change by community, and some of the considerations there, depending on what was caught, can be a concern. And so we also look at the interaction between wind lease areas and protected species, and we are trying to evaluate how active lease areas might impact specifically right whale foraging habitat and prey availability. Okay, last more... more fun piece. This is where we talk about the end of year summary, like what happened just last year. And we tried a bit harder this year to solicit feedback from the industry and the general public. And so the council staff helped by putting in the newsletter. And I know I've contacted some of you to help solicit this. And we have been kind of advertising it with the Cooperative Research Branch and did a presentation at the Cooperative Research Summit last 2 weeks ago. But this is an effort to better incorporate data that might not be in our traditional data streams, things that people have seen, cross-reference observations, turn anecdotes into narratives to better understand what's currently happening in places that we aren't looking because we can't have a survey out everywhere every day. And so we start with some of the things that we do have data for. So that's the oceanography. We have satellites that are looking throughout the year, and we have data collection that's fairly consistent for environmental signals. So we're seeing cold water this year. The Gulf Stream moved way south than it had in previous years. We're back to kind of the long-term average position of the Gulf Stream, which allows a lot more water to come in from Canadian currents. And so the dynamics of this are changing year to year and have also interact with what the atmospheric weather is doing. So last year was very cold in the air, and we had cold water coming in. And so this kept conditions, you know, substantially cooler than they have been in the last 10 years or so. But the actual mechanism that's, you know, happening in the ocean, the currents are not consistent year to year. And so what that means is that the water quality can change despite the temperature being similar. And when we were getting feedback from the industry this year, a lot of the observations were relating to these colder water conditions. So fishers saw black sea bass and bluefish off of Rhode Island in places, well, they didn't see bluefish off of Rhode Island. They were expecting them, but the migrations were apparently different than they had been previous years. And so we don't know what route they're taking when they have these conditions and whether any marine development interacts with some of these processes. It could be fairly complex to figure out why, but this section is mostly focusing on reporting what happened. We do have evidence that this was like a really good year for white marlin, and there was 23,000 white marlin caught. So that was not necessarily due to the cooler water, but it could be if they were following certain prey that were more abundant or more easily accessible. As I mentioned, in the Mid-Atlantic, there's some species that aren't cold tolerant, and so they did have reports of species in the Chesapeake reacting adversely to cooler conditions. But there's a lot of talk amongst the industry about the relationship between cooler conditions and things like mackerel, ilex, and sand lance. And so I think that these are the kinds of things that spark us to investigate these relationships, especially if these conditions continue. And then lastly, we got good reports for recruitment for scallops and elephant trunk from the survey. And we're seeing kind of some unusual cold water copepod species in the Gulf of Maine, kind of signaling that these are kind of wide scale changes that are happening and not just a one-off event. It's been a couple of years like this, so we're trying to understand how or what to expect for the system. So that was a lot. Thank you for letting me present this on behalf of the 88 contributors we have across 20 institutions. So it's really a big effort, and it's growing, and it gets the balance between getting bigger every year and then trying to be more concise. So I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Caracappa. Once again, I mean, this is a great product, all the effort that you guys go into on this. We're going to break here before we go to the SSC's review of this, and I think we want to open up, obviously, discussions, comments on the product that was put before us. But also, I would like to see council members think about efficiencies, as Dr. Caracappa said. You know, there's a lot of work, and you heard multiple times, we're going to look into this. So it's expanding. Keep in mind, they do this for both the New England and the Mid-Atlantic. So there's two reports, and we do this on an annual basis. Sounds like it's coming a little unwieldy on their behalf. I mean, they seem to enjoy it. They love to enjoy it. But thinking about efficiencies, do we need separate reports? Do we need on an annual basis? Just think about, this is actually the third time I've seen this presentation in 2 weeks. And, you know, just thinking about efficiencies on their side, you know, could we maybe take this out of a specific council 45-minute presentation that you just did and maybe make a day of it for a wider group of people to have more interaction with the report itself? So any comments council members can kind of think about, not beyond just the report of what was presentation, but thinking about the future and efficiency. So I will open up to the council for any questions or comments. Mr. Pappalardo.
Thank you, Joe. The definition of stability changed in the report this year. So neither fisheries nor ecosystem are considered stable according to the report. I'm just trying to think through what like practical management implications would be. Should the council start thinking about acceptable risk and rebuilding implications, management responsiveness, things of that nature based on the stability portion of the report? How would you interpret that?
Yeah, thanks. Good catch. I didn't dwell on it too much, but we were previously reporting stability as just those diversity metrics and we decided this year that that was not actually addressing the concerns that we've heard about stability. And so this was the reframing, and then based on those criteria, we're not stable. But that's not like an actionable status. We're not suggesting like what could be done to be more stable, and we're not actually evaluating a specific objective. I think we have the objective is to be stable, but that is based on the definition that we've come up with that might not be feasible. But I think the question for the council would be, what aspects of stability that are within the council's control do you want to try to address? So what's the desired state here? And then we can evaluate whether we're getting further or closer to that instead of this binary plus or minus stability, because that that might not be as informative as the former.
Thanks. I asked a question. You asked me a question. I'm going to ask you a question. One of the other things I noticed that was much stronger this year in the report was a continued focus on the changing distributional shifts, timing shifts, productivity concerns. Where do you see the clearest mismatch now between the biology and the way we still manage by area, season, and stock structure?
So off the cuff, there's two main ones. Species distributions are pretty well documented. Shifts in species distributions, and I think there's enough evidence that, especially on a state-by-state level, that where catch is coming from might not have reflected history. So evaluating some of those jurisdictional allocation-related questions, I think, is one thing that we can provide evidence to support. And then the second would be with regards to some of the dynamic reference point work, if we're trying to reevaluate what our assumptions on stock productivity are and what the reference points should be and how you manage based on that, I think that would be my second choice.
Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Joe. Very interesting presentation. A couple of years ago, when the cold water, the Labrador Current refreshed, there was a question on whether it was from the slope water upwelling or Arctic ice melt. And one would be nutrient rich, one would not be. Is there any further studies on that? What's the going consensus on the nutrients that are coming down with this cold water?
So a lot of this is retroactive analysis. So we're looking at 2 years ago. I think they were assessing that because of the oxygen conditions, that was most likely coming from Arctic and was associated with ice melt as well as the Gulf Stream changes. But this year, we're not seeing the same type of water quality signature. So I don't think they've evaluated that. But that is one of the hypotheses, that it's slope water intrusion. We're working with a lot of it's coming from, to rule that out, it's coming from Canada. So we're working with DFO to see if we can share some of the data they've collected on the Scotian Shelf to better understand like what the changes there and if that has downstream impacts here. So not a full answer, but
okay.
Yeah.
Well, just a little bit of follow-up on that. If it is nutrient-rich, you would expect some kind of biological marker where a response. You get this extra nutrients, you get a response on a plankton level or somewhere else. I think managed species would probably be delayed just because I don't think you'll get the markers until they're large enough to be seen. But you say it's only been 2 or 3 years where we've had this little bit of a shift. Maybe it's just instability. Hopefully it's a indication of a decadal trend, but even stability is a good marker. But I just, I was searching for some kind of increase in the last 2 days. There are 2 years. There's a couple of plankton markers that you showed on George's Bank that were up, but there was also some that were down, and the productivity is always trending down. So I'm looking for a bright spot in this report and not seeing it yet, but hopefully it'll show up in the next year or two.
That's a great suggestion to look at the nutrients. Thank you.
Dr. Hare?
Yeah, thank you. I was a little slow on the response. And going back to Mr. Pappalardo's first question, I don't remember you provided sort of a list of management items that you were asking the scientists to provide a response to. But I think the science indicates that the ecosystem is not currently stable. And so all the questions that you raised are excellent questions that could be discussed by managers is how to respond to an ecosystem that the scientists are telling you is not stable. So it's more of a question, from my opinion, for this group to consider not for, you know, a scientist to answer on their own. It's a joint problem that needs joint discussion. So just a reflection on the first part of your question.
I agree. I'd like to phone a friend. I'd like to bring the SSC into that conversation to help advise us. But I was specifically thinking about a topic that's coming up later today, and that's our risk policy. So hopefully we can reflect on this presentation today, the Q&A, and then apply it when we start thinking about Megan's presentation, because she's bringing a whopper forward.
Thank you for that. Up next, Mr. Smith and then Mr. Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Joe, thanks for the presentation. I have two questions, if I could. The first one is a follow-up on Eric's question regarding some of the cooler water temperatures we've seen over the last year or so. And I was curious if any of the, I think it's MOM-6, the operational forecast models, whether any of those forecast models predicted this or forecasted it. And regardless of the answer to that, how are the models dealing with what we're seeing now, which is some cooler water temperatures?
Yeah, so they actually did predict it. So they ran a simulation, a 10-year projection in 2022 that predicted a big cooling event, and then that is what happened. The magnitude of the cooling event was not exactly the same, but when you're looking at a long-term forecast, that's really telling you, this is the 10-year forecast. So those are telling you the signal, like what's the direction you're going in. You wouldn't use that to evaluate where exactly you're going to be in 10 years. So what we're seeing now with the short-term forecast, those are one-year outlooks. Those are fairly good at bottom temperature and surface temperature. And we are currently, there's projects right now to evaluate other aspects like oxygen and phytoplankton production that might be linking to some of the other questions about productivity a bit better. But that's a one-year outlook, so you're not going to get like a 10-year projection from that. So I think to help focus some of those efforts, understanding what the specific management concerns are for that kind of 10-year timescale would help maybe target how we assess the usefulness of those long-term forecasts. Thanks.
Well, it's great that it predicted it and it happened. Maybe that's a piece of good news you were looking for, Eric. I don't know. So the second question I have was with regards to the effort that was made to get fishermen's input on the on the report. It sounds like you've invested a little bit more in that. I was at the Cooperative Research Summit, saw you there. I thought that was one of the most fascinating sessions of the whole thing, was seeing fishermen up there on the maps, drawing things that they had observed up there. And I asked this question of you then, and maybe it wasn't the right room to do it in, maybe this is. So I'm very curious how we can work to try to get some of those observations that fishermen are sharing into the assessment process for stock assessments or the management room that we're in now. I think we're struggling a little bit just initially with trying to get some of the harder science data, like here's what the temperature is or here's what the chlorophyll was, into our science and management. And I'm very interested in trying to figure out how we can get fishermen's observations into that. So any thoughts on how we can turn those great observations into us helping us do a better job managing species in a changing environment?
So unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you how to do that part exactly, but I can tell you how we are thinking about using it in the report, because I don't really know how to best implement it in something like an assessment. So our approach for this is to collect the information like we would any other kind of data source, and then look at it all side by side and try to pose questions based on the patterns that emerge from the input from the industry. And so if we get a lot of things that are in alignment, that provides a hypothesis that we can look at the data and see if we can verify it. And if we don't have data for it, can we come up with some plausible suggestions in the meantime? And so I think one thing that's been successful is by posing it as a collaborative effort. We're not trying to like take something from the industry. We're trying to build scientific questions using the industry's input and then actually incorporating that into the main product to explain why current events are happening and to kind of build on other evidence, use it as one of many sources of evidence for something. So I think that's been useful for us. I don't know if it would work for the other aspects that the council wants to incorporate input into, but thanks.
And then, Mr. Chair, just very quickly to your question to us as council members, I think there would be advantage to combining the MID report and the New England report. I think a lot of the information that is presented in the report spans both areas. I don't even know what the difference between the two is, but I guess it's about what managed species they have rather than what ours are. I think it would make sense to combine them into two for efficiency purposes, unless Joe or his team think there's a big reason we shouldn't do it. So that's my thought on that one.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I think what we'll do if we get more feedback, obviously we'll provide it to Dr. Caracappa and his team, and it's up to them. It's their product, you know, it's up to them. But if we feel that this is would be helpful for them, you know, they can go with it. Up next, I have Terry Alexander, then Mr. Pierdnock.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the presentation. It was interesting. So a lot of things that really stuck out to me, and it were, you know, the shifts from Georges Bank revenue to the Gulf of Maine, which makes perfect sense to me. Over the last few years, we've had a whole lot of fishermen leave Portland, Maine, and fish out of New Bedford, Massachusetts, but they still fish in the Gulf of Maine. So, I mean, that would make perfect sense to me, that those boats that used to go to Georges go to the Gulf of Maine. And, you know, and everything that we do as a commercial fishery, I don't care if you ground fish, scallop, whatever you do, is based on quota. If quota's available and it's in your backyard, you're going to stay in that area. You know, if quota's costing you a dollar a pound to go here, then you're going to go over here where the quota's cheaper. So I don't know how to get that into this, but every move we make, as far as that doesn't mean that there isn't something there to catch. It just means we don't want to pay for it, so we're going to go over here. And you know, John Hare, when he was talking about, you know, it might be a management decision, I think it's a cart horse thing. I mean, we need the quota in order to be able to make management decisions. And, you know, I mean, so, yeah, every move I make with my business, which is a ground fish boat, is based on quota. Like, we have not landed a fish off Georges Bank this year. And normally we're 25-30% of our time we're spending on Georges Banks. But I just looked at my landings for the entire year, because our sector manager tells us what we've caught throughout the year every week. And we have not landed one trip off Georges Banks, not 1 pound off Georges Banks this year. And that's because the quota down there is almost none. And so next year when you do this again, you're going to really see the shift to the Gulf of Maine, because there was no haddock quota out there this year. And, you know, the codfish quota is going for $2 a pound. So, I mean, so you're really going to see that shift really expand this year, I think. So just a couple points I thought I'd point out to you. So thank you.
No, thank you. That's helpful. We've been, I think one thing we've discussed is evaluating just what you're talking about, trips that are fishing in areas that they didn't normally, or landing in ports that aren't their home port. So trying to capture the market of what the port to fishing grounds changes look like. That landscape's pretty dynamic, so it's been challenging. But thank you.
Thank you very much. Up next, I have Mr. Pierdnock and then Mr. Lucy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. There's good stuff in here. I know the recreational community has provided input with, I see a lot of the results of that with the observations that are in there, so that's positive to see. It's going in the right direction. Just a few questions on slide 15. It has the metrics for recreational catch. Is the pelagics for sharks only, or has that been includes all the different pelagics that are targeted recreationally? Because there's a footnote there, and it wasn't clear to me whether it's just sharks, because it notes that Mako is closed.
It is not all HMS, highly migratory species. The data is there. We weren't able to get it into the report this year for timing, but I think we found the fix. So I don't know if, yeah, to answer your question, it's not comprehensive.
Okay. I recommend, because when you look at that slide and you look at slide 21 and 22, 2010, it's at the peak. And that was when cod was everywhere. And today's tax day, but April 15th, back in the day, used to be the opening day of cod season. It was like a circus, and it would proceed for about a month. And as you look at that from 2010 on, you see the catch and the effort going down because of the changes to the cod regulations and the cutbacks and the closures and so on. So, I mean, up here, there's a few species that I'd say cod, striped bass, bluefin tuna, black sea bass. If you took those metrics, there'd be a completely different outcome of decreases and increases that it's not clear, or it doesn't look like it's reflected in this. So I would ask that possibly you look at that and include specifically the pelagics, bluefin tuna, big eye tuna, yellowfin tuna, different sharks. But also those indicators, cod, striped bass, bluefin tuna, and black sea bass. Now, with that, the question about effectiveness, as Jeff said, recommendation maybe to include the Mid and New England Fishery Management Council. Those species, there's a difference in a sense whether you're north of the Cape or south of the Cape. And a lot of those species from the northern range of them is south of the Cape. And the metrics are then different if you look north or south, and it'd be a completely different outcome with the graphs that are indicated there. So the food for thought that it may be good to combine the two, but when it's being looked at, that demarcation line is somewhat telling a different story north or south of there recreationally. One last thing. In slide 23, it's interesting with the ports and this issue with basing it on recreational port activity and population size has always been somewhat problematic with the metrics, because recreationally, when you look at those ports, the reliance is on tourists typically coming in, and especially on the Cape and the islands, the phone's ringing off the hook for the for-hire fleet from Memorial Day to Labor Day and in between, and all the recreational anglers that are coming in either fishing there or going on a for-hire trip is not based on a population that's there year-round. So I just want to point that out, because the metrics may be a little off of what you're really trying to get to, which is a little different with the reality of what's actually occurring. Thank you.
Thank you for the suggestion. Yeah, the rec port activity indicator, we're working with the social scientists to revise that for next year based not just on the population size, but some other aspects. But I think we're open to feedback on how to best do that. So thank you.
Mr. Lucy?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Excellent presentation. To Dan's suggestion, whatever we need to do to keep growing this, because there's obviously a lot more questions we need to get answered, and this is the basis of all fisheries. This is the productivity of the system. This is the engine under the hood. So whatever will assist the science center, whether it's combining reports or focusing on certain aspects of it, I'm all for. I know the resources are reduced, but hopefully that's not a permanent situation. I did have one specific question about the advection rates. Have you looked at those rates and tried to correlate them in the past to some of these anomalies in recruitment? So you get some of those strange, optimistic little tails in our recruitment models in certain species, or, you know, we'll get an anomaly like this huge haddock recruitment, I think it was 2017. And you think those advection rates could be operationalized at some point to maybe forecast something like that?
So I think what you could do with that, speaking for myself, would be if you understood enough about the larval phase and the juvenile habitat. I mean, one could look at the ocean models and try to look at the connectivity between the spawning stock and the recruitment grounds and get an indicator for how much is getting lost. It's not always as straightforward as larval supply equals recruitment. But it, for some stocks, it might be good to look at some of those anomalous years. It's hard to generate cause and effect without like a big analysis, but I think it's worth looking at the stock level for sure, especially separating like different depth layers and locations, because that was the whole continental shelf margin that we were looking at, and not all species are concerned with that reference point. So, thanks.
Ms. Griffin, then Scott, and then I want to cut us off so we can get to the SSC's feedback, that phone a friend that Mr. Popolo was looking for.
Yeah, I'd say as a manager, I'm really excited about the transformation of this report and the responsiveness from your group on its content and format for its utility for us in management decisions. So, you know, to that end, listening to this discussion just now, I've heard comments about collaborative efforts and getting managers and scientists engaged in dialogue. So I wanted to pick up on what our chair had asked us at the beginning about potential efficiencies. And I love the idea of a single day meeting, not tied to a specific council, where we get to discuss the status of the ecosystem for all the regions. I think this would provide a really meaningful opportunity for us to get a little bit more in the weeds with questions and discussions among the scientists and managers in the fishing industry. I would appreciate that the logistics probably would call for that not to be annual, maybe start with every 2 years or something. But I like that idea instead of you having to go through multiple presentations to different groups.
Thank you. Mr. Olszewski, and then we'll bring up Dr. McManus.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Caracappa. That was a lot of work, a lot of information there, very informative. I just had a really quick question, and I'm just more curious. I looked around to see if there were other ecosystem reports from around the nation, and I'm curious on some of the management objectives like seafood production and commercial profits and recreational opportunities. Are the trends similar to what we're seeing in sort of the Northeast? I guess I'm trying to gauge and measure like our management performance overall. Thanks.
So with respect to those objectives, currently they are not standardized across all regions. They are only standardized between the Mid-Atlantic and New England. Other regions have similar reports, but they address region-specific management concerns. We don't all use the same metric. We're working on trying to use more of the same language to discuss. But with regards to the Mid-Atlantic, I might have that. Generally, the similarities are declining seafood production is similar for the Mid-Atlantic, and the Mid-Atlantic has a higher reliance on some of those environmentally sensitive species, mostly because of the inland bays. I think Chesapeake, most of the communities are highly dependent on sensitive species, so that weights it. But with regards to stability, they're also the same. they're both fishery and ecosystem don't have any. They're both marked as not stable, but I can't remember the revenue, so I would have to get back to you on that. But outside of that, that would be an interesting project to actually compare objectives across regions. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. And up next, we'll bring up Dr. McManus to get the review from the SSC on the report. This happened last week, 2 weeks ago? Recently. I know that. Dr. McManus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Caracappa, for the review of the SOE. When we met, I believe last Monday, we had two terms of reference to address as it relates to the State of the Ecosystem Report. The first was trying to recommend key signals described in that report for the council that would allow for thinking more about management decisions over the next year, and also recommend potential improvements, as we have in previous years, to the report. And so just like overarching comments, I think, you know, similar to the council's sentiments today, we were very appreciative of the report. Each year it has grown with very thorough information addressing a suite of potential discussion topics that could be reviewed from science and management perspectives. We really appreciate the number of people that are committed to trying to keep the report moving. The information is of really high quality. And I also want to quickly note our thanks towards addressing our comments year after year, both with positive reception of that, as well as documenting them, so that makes our life a little bit easier as we move from year to year in trying to provide feedback and making sure we're not being repetitive and redundant. So as it relates to the first terms of reference, we had a couple of quick feedbacks on the recommended key signals described in the report. The SSC commented how it really enjoyed having the risks and meeting management objectives there, again, giving some high-level understandings or context for spatial and seasonal management, catch limits and marine development activities. And the Bennett indicator was welcomed by the SSC as it really tries to understand changes in revenue, particularly providing context of whether this is attributed more towards price or volume within that metric. Additionally, the SSC has continued to enjoy and see use for prey and thermal indicators within this system, particularly for in an environment that has seen change over the years and getting us better context for why we are seeing certain changes as they relate to managed fisheries. The inclusion of MOM-6 bottom temperature forecasts was particularly exciting for us, and really thinking about not just where we're at, but now where we potentially are going, and led to certain discussions about how in the future this would be a useful tool for us in trying to think about environmentally explicit decisions as it relates, or informed decisions as they relate to future catch advice. Ecosystem trends associated with particular species were also welcomed and received well by the SSC, particularly with the example of trying to contextualize things like ocean acidification, which is an important but perhaps a little bit more isolated interaction with some of the species that we manage within this region, such as with scallops. As it relates to TORB, in terms of recommended improvements to future reports, the first was thinking about how use this information in the context of fisheries management, particularly with either individual species or species within an FMP. One thing that the SSC noted was it'd be really helpful to start to continue to think about and document the different ways information from SOEs or environmental data at large are used to help inform fisheries stock assessments within our region. We kind of mentioned that some type of tabular index or format for documenting instances where such information and SOEs are used within the stock assessment or management process would be useful. So as an example, thinking about perhaps yellowtail flounder stocks, where there have been assessments now with either Gulf Stream Index or bottom water temperatures being used to inform the assessment model, if we could start to documenting these case studies, that would be really useful for providing additional context for and insight as to other ways that we could start to work towards a similar adaptations for some of our managed species within the region. And we also discussed perhaps is there some way or future to derive more species-specific information from the SOE, which would be useful for us as we enter deliberations on catch advice recommendations and such, and give us more specific context for individual species or stocks. As it relates to the marine development elements within the SOE, there was also discussion about not just looking at interactions with the fishery, but fishery surveys and providing context for potential elevated increased uncertainty in estimates if there is and how that may be changing through space and time. That would be useful for, I guess, thinking about particularly assessments or data updates where we're heavily leaning on fishery surveys. There was a bit of discussion too about the plots that we've seen over the years of looking at stock status and for each of the stocks we manage in the New England region. We get these snapshots in the report, and so there was discussion as well about whether it would be useful to kind of understand whether there are change how the species or stocks have moved in and out of different overfished statuses over time. So it gives us a sense of, you know, where we may be gravitating over a longer term perspective. And we also discussed that in the context of performance, it may be also useful to understand for the New England stocks underutilized quota or where there are opportunities between like a catch and the quota that we've actually realized within the fishery to that provide better context and maybe insight as to where there are opportunities in the future for certain fisheries within our region. Moving into some of the management objectives, we also talked about whether there should be something akin to a ecosystem health objective. It seems like a lot of this information is currently parked within other management objectives. So we were wondering whether it would make sense if this information could be a standalone object and be a bit of its own entity as we think about the different objectives for the system. And we really appreciated the understanding of diversity for species in this region and understanding those over time. If there are opportunities to think about classifying species or as cold water or warm water preferencing, that might provide additional insight as to why we're seeing changes in diversity from some of these indices. Similar to some of the discussion we had earlier, we appreciated the stability discussion. We also shared a similar concern that to folks not too in-depth with what we're doing at first read, the stability and non-stability definitions may be misinterpreted. So we suggested that while we didn't have an immediate solution, we were wondering if different terminology would be useful, something like equilibrium or something of that nature that would maybe allow for better representing the goals of the metric. And just kind of iterating too, we appreciate the delineation between New England Council managed species and all species, and so we reinforced better, you know, making sure those distinctions are clear throughout, you know, whether they are the council managed species or not, state and federal fisheries or not. That those are things that would be really helpful in just making sure it's clear to what we're looking at. And largely this is addressed throughout, but there are major fisheries in the region that aren't managed by the council, so just it's really important to distinguish those two. For the Bennett indicator, we had recommended thinking about the start year for this relativity. So all the indices are relative to the 1982 year, which was the beginning of the time series of data that's to be used. And there was discussion as to whether it's useful to think of developing the indicator with a different start year, depending on the questions or the FMPs of interest, and really kind of hone in on some of the differences because the those inferences are somewhat reflective of the start year or dependent on that. And then lastly, we had discussions about the different metrics to understand communities. And so we appreciated the build out of these other definitions as there and ways to understand impacts on communities. But we also thought that it may be really useful to like further evaluate community impacts as a whole in terms, not just the data, but like what are the different dimensions of which communities could be impacted, and then think about whether we have the data or these different data streams can help us support understanding those changes over time. And I think that's our presentation. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. McManus. That was very helpful. I think listening to the SSC, you guys had a really good deliberation around this report, and I think very good feedback. I will come back to the council. I will open it up to both Dr. McManus and Dr. Karakap. I know there were a few lingering hands, so I will go to Mr. Platts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, both of you. My comments were left over from the first presentation, so they'll mostly go there, although they sync well with your presentation, Connor. I had a lot of same thoughts that you brought out. So more of a rhetorical question, I was just wondering, how you measured gross and managed revenue for the ecosystem, the species, and then for the fishing profitability. And I'm not really looking for an answer to that so much as just an understanding of it in future presentations and consistency across measures and timeframes and species. The particular metrics maybe aren't so critical, but I think where the rubber is going to hit the road for the council in terms of value from the considerable cost that obviously went into putting this all together is for, you know, what jumped out to me is the difference in the managed stocks declining versus the ecosystem as a whole not declining. So I think that's a real reference point for us. And, Terry touched on it with the economics of fishing and why some point fish species are more exploited than others, and ties in with that. And then Mike picked up a little bit on it as well, as like there's going to be differentiation between different species. And I think the rubber is going to hit the road for us if we can somehow look at these metrics in terms of different managed stocks with more of a focus on individual stocks compared to the ecosystem and compared to each other and over time frame, and see if we can identify points where, that help us understand the decline in the managed stocks. And are these, management issues? Are they cold water or warm water sensitivities? Or, as I put before Connor spoke, environmental sensitivity or sensitivity, the intensity of exploitation. I think that's, those would provide a lot of really good management reference points for the council and help us study the economics of our decision making and maybe where it's succeeding or where it's not necessarily succeeding. But I thought it was a great presentation and really useful, helpful information. Thank you.
Ms. O'Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So thank you both for your presentations. A lot of work has gone into this Day of the Ecosystem report, and I really appreciate the addition of the new indicator, which is the index of revenue, commercial, the costs and profits from federal trips, which I think was on slide 19 or slide 20, both for the commercial as well as the recreational fishery, and looking at some of those. Big picture wise, I hope that we can begin to think about how to coordinate some of these new indicators that have been brought into the State of the Ecosystem report when we think about risk policy moving forward and some of those factors and weightings that'll happen in our later discussion as a council. So I'm hoping we can connect those and bring some of the value of this work that's been done maybe into the next phase of what we'll be doing as a council. But just curious, Joe, in looking at costs and profits, Terry Alexander had mentioned, the shift in some of our fisheries that have occurred based on like the availability of quota. And I'm assuming that when we think about costs, we're looking at leasing costs, as well as other costs that may be, I know that this is federal trip, so this isn't specific to one fishery, but it would, it's important to recognize there are a lot of costs individually with some of our fisheries, such as leasing for groundfish. And I don't know if you're considering those costs or how those are folded in, as well as I'm assuming there's no, it's looking at costs today, so it wouldn't maybe necessarily think about, you know, potential for like at-sea monitoring costs if those were added on. But just curious what information's being used for the cost. If you remember. So sorry, I'm like going deep into the data.
it's an estimate based on distance traveled and some of the fixed costs associated with a trip. So I'd have to double check if the leasing costs are in there. I know that labor is not, and some of the other variable costs that are associated with trips. We have a cost survey that was not part of that index that we're trying to incorporate going forward, but the cost dynamics across the entire region, like you said, are very complex and fishery specific. So I think we should try to reconcile all those, or maybe split things out if it would be helpful. If there's specific groupings of types of trips that would be useful to split out, we're also open to kind of separating that data out into. Yeah, thank you.
I think it's just helpful to build this into like our understanding of what's going on in terms of the performance of our fishery, whether it's at an ecosystem level like the Gulf of Maine or Georges Bank, or whether it's at, you know, broken down a little bit more by fishery. I think the performance would be really important for us to consider. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Jackie. Obviously, when we think about lease costs, we're specifically talking to groundfish, although we are talking about the scallop limited access general category. But even on a groundfish trip, not everything is a lease cost. So it's definitely an interesting concept. It's a big knot that we would have to untie, but definitely something to think about. Seeing no more questions, I thank you both for both of your presentations. I see. No, Terry, you can talk to them after. Thank you. We'll take a 10-minute break. Dr. McManus will come back, give a few other presentations on some work that the SSC has reviewed. So give you 10 minutes, be back here at 10:50-ish.